When my wife and I got married, my wife told me that she wanted to have 6 kids total. With intense and brutal negotiations, I managed to talk her down to just 2. I was really sweating it. Her doctor told her that she should never have any more kids, that the pregnancy would be very hard on her, and that she would probably lose the baby. But it didn't stop us, nor her, and we're glad that we didn't. We're glad that we went ahead and didn't listen to the doctor. But after 4 miscarriages, we finally made it through the first trimester, and we was feeling pretty good about that. But that didn't last too long, for it wasn't long when she started having problems with the pregnancy. We had to make many trips to the hospital to keep from losing the baby. And we made several trips to our minister to have anointed by him for both my wife, the child, and the pregnancy. And our journey continued. Even though we did all that we could, all the trips to the hospital and the trips to the minister's house for anointing, our son decided that he was coming early, about 6 weeks early. I rushed my wife to the hospital for the birth of our son. The doctor came in and he had a list of all these things that could be wrong with our son when he was born. He sat down and read all these things to us and told us to expect one, if not more than one, of these things to be wrong. I've actually never heard so many different syndromes in all my life, but it was pretty scary. At this time, I started praying nonstop. I prayed over and over and over, and I prayed hard. I even prayed some of the prayers over sometimes because I was running out of things to say. I prayed that my son would be perfect. When the birth started, they brought in a team of 6 doctors ready to do whatever they had to save or deal with the problems our son might have. I was still praying nonstop and praying hard. As soon as our son was born, the team of doctors swooped him right up and laid him on the table and surrounded him. I didn't even get to see him. I could see the doctors all standing around him working like crazy, checking and testing and doing whatever they had. And me, I'm still standing in the corner going, because I'm not sure what is going on, and I was worried about the baby. At this time, I'm no longer praying. The time for prayer was before his birth, and now after his birth, the time for prayer had passed. For now, he is here, and whatever ails him, it will be. Now I'm just waiting to hear the news from the team of doctors that was checking out our son. I can't even explain the feelings and the things that was going through my mind, but I can say that I almost couldn't take it. I was so scared for our son. All at once, every doctor standing around in a circle around my son stopped everything at the same time. They looked at each other with a shocking look on their faces. And again, everyone at the very same time shrugged their shoulders. When I saw this, I knew without a doubt that God was telling me that my son was perfect. And it was at that time that I forced my way between all these doctors to see my son for the very first time. Not only was he perfect, but he was also beautiful. Out of all the whole list that was read to us, not one thing was wrong with our son. Many times I have had people walk up to me and say, "My name is so-and-so. I am a born-again Christian." They love letting you know that they are born-again Christians. I say, if you are a born-again Christian, then you are in big trouble. Because when I shook your hand, I still felt flesh and blood. John 3 and verse 5, Jesus answered, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a man be born of water and of spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven. Verse 6. With this is born of the flesh is flesh, and what which is born of the spirit is spirit. Brothers and sisters, we are not born yet. That will happen when Christ, our brother, returns to earth. We are still just babes in Christ. We have much developing to do still yet, and much more to learn. And still, many, many more trials to come our way before we are ready to be born again. Now, this is the time for prayer. Pray every day, nonstop, and pray hard, and pray over and over. And prayer for each other. Pray for each other, for we are all a family. Pray that our faith is strengthened. Pray that we be strong without doubt. Pray that we become perfect, just like our Father in heaven. Just like we read in Colossians 4, verse 12. Epaphras, who is one of you, a servant of Christ, salute you always, laboring fervently for your prayers, that he may stand perfect and complete in all the will of God. Brothers and sisters, no matter what or how bad your trials have been in your lifetime, no matter what or how bad your trials may be on this very day, just like all the trips my wife and I took to the hospital and all the trips to our minister's house for prayer and anointing, and even though my son came early, pray and pray nonstop. Pray hard. And you can and you will be perfect, just like our son. Don't ever, ever give up. Don't wait till the day that Christ returns, for on that day, prayers will be too late. Even though my son did come early, he did wait just long enough to be a gift for me on Father's Day by 20 minutes.
This is the fourth B-side I've been to already. Panama City, it was just great. It rained. I mean, we had a little bit of everything. It was probably in the mid-80s, and then it was in the 90s, and then it rained. Rained hot water. But then a cool front came through, and it was just absolutely gorgeous. I mean, when you see the sun in the early morning shining on those waves coming in off the Gulf, it is just spectacular. So they've had a little bit of everything down there, and the feast got off with a bang. 200-plus people in the room on the first day. And, of course, I hated to leave there because Michael and Melody and my mom and my brothers and their kids and so many other friends and everything and some golf buddies, too. But I left them behind and went to Myrtle Beach. I think last year they were straining to get registration up to 200. They started off with a bang, 234. And I'm sure that the numbers will go up from there as the week progresses. Quite a number of people visiting from actually some of the other groups. Some of them are probably going to get kicked out for doing it, too. And we'll have to see. Or either they just have to not tell their preacher where they've been. And then Indiana. I see, you know, from the airplane, I just can't believe this country we live in, how much there is of it, and how absolutely fertile and gorgeous it is. And when you get up there into the Corn Belt and up into the, Illinois and Indiana, oh, it is just gorgeous. And, I hate that. I'm hoping that the sun will come out here and maybe we'll still have a half-decent day. I'm told that's not supposed to happen. But, hey, we're not beyond the realm of miracles, and I've got a whole bunch of them to talk to you about today. Gorgeous in Indiana. They've only got, I think, about 56 or 58 people. But a wonderful little crowd it is. And they're happy as they can be up there. that land is so beautiful. It's, you know, I don't know if you can draw some kind of a mental image of what the kingdom of God is supposed to be like, but that's got to come pretty close, especially when you go out to the golf course. They were going to play 18 holes after church yesterday, and it was just tearing my heart out that I wasn't going to be able to play. But they did take me out to the first tee. I played two holes, and then they ran me back and rushed me off to the airport, another gentleman who was standing by. So I did get to play two holes in paradise and enjoyed that very much. I wish I'd been bitten by the bug, because it would have been great if I could have golfed when my dad was alive, because he was quite an accomplished golfer. And it wasn't that I didn't try. It's just that I couldn't wrap my mind or my body around it at the time, and I just never could seem to do it. But at any rate, now it's got me hooked. And I know why my dad loved it, because it's just peace and tranquility, and it requires a lot of control and your self-control and thought control and other things that are actually assets to us that are helpful. And I suspect that if any sports are going to be in the kingdom, you know, golf's probably going to be one of them. You know, it may be a par three from Southern California to Honolulu. I don't know, but we'll have to wait and see. You know, it's been a tradition with the feast, either at the beginning or whenever my grandfather showed up on the scene, he usually would get up and he would start, "Now, brethren, why are we here?" And I know you've had sermons to talk about why you're here, and as they have at the other feast sites. But lately, I have been realizing something from a little bit of another standpoint that I think is something that we should have been taught and haven't been. Even I grew up in Imperial schools and in the shadow of Ambassador College, went a couple of years to Ambassador College. That's about all I could do. And am stunned at how much we don't know, and how much I still don't know. I mean, I'm just beginning to get a little bit of an inkling of what I want to talk about today, but maybe enough that I can pass it along and give you a little bit of the same sense that has been quite an inspiration leading up to this feast and during this feast so far for me. We're not only here at the Feast of Tabernacles to commemorate our forefathers being led out of slavery in Egypt, although that's the beginning of it, obviously. And we're not only here to commemorate the coming kingdom of God, but that's another reason why we're here. But one of the reasons that we're here is because that the men who discovered this country and the early settlers in this country, and our early presidents, our founders, our forefathers, one of the reasons that we're able to be here observing God's Feast of Tabernacles and reminiscing about Israel and looking forward to the return of Jesus Christ and adhering to God's gospel is because when our forefathers came to this land, they knew who they were, and they reestablished the covenant that God made with Israel on our shores in the United States of America. They looked at this land as a new Jerusalem. Well, they named one of the earliest settlements Salem, which, of course, is the root word of Jerusalem, and it means peace. But the miracles that God gave them to allow that to happen are just mind-boggling. And I wonder, why in the world is that not the crux of our children's education? Why wasn't it the crux of my education? Why isn't it the centerpiece of our entertainment? I mean, the stories that I'm beginning to read and the miraculous things that happened are the greatest stories never told. They just truly are. But what I have learned recently, and am continuing to learn as I go, is that we're not just the physical and the spiritual descendants of Israel, We here in the United States, and this includes all races, and of course, as Galatians 3:26 points out, but we are a covenant people with God. Not only us in the church, but our country is a covenant nation that God has blessed. And we are the people who bear a tremendous responsibility for preserving the special blessings that God bestowed through birthright, down through Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then Joseph and his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Obviously, this was a great theme of my grandfather's, and he wrote that book, United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy, borrowing heavily from another book that was called Judas Scepter and Joseph's Birthright. And I've come upon another book of later date that includes research from a great many of those early sources. But before I get to that, I'd like to ask you to turn to Genesis chapter 49, if you would. And we realize it in the passage that I want to read is beginning in verse 22. But this entire chapter relates to the time when Jacob was a very old man. And he knew he wasn't long for this world. And you look back at the beginning of the chapter, it says that he called unto his sons and said, Gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. Now, isn't that interesting? Jacob's name, of course, was changed to Israel. But the nation of Israel didn't even exist yet. Jacob is talking to his sons to tell them what will become of them in the last days. This is before there were even tribes. This is before Israel was a nation. And yet, he tells what will befall them in the last days, and he goes through the various sons, but in verse 22, he gets to Joseph. He says, Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. Now, that probably was a little hard to understand. You know, what branches, what wall? I've come across a book recently that has had quite a tremendous impact on me. The name of it is The Covenant. One Nation Under God. And the subtitle, America's Sacred and Immutable Connection to Ancient Israel. As I've gone through, and I got probably a couple of chapters in before I came across, and this book is littered with footnotes and with bibliography and numerous sources. There were 10 years involved in the research of this subject. Funny, it took a gentleman and his staff 10 years to try to compile all the things that we should have known all our lives if our generations had been faithful in carrying forward the blessings and the miracles that it took to bring us to this blessed land and to place us here where we could, in peace and in safety, observe and proclaim God's word and his laws. Well, when I got somewhere about chapter 2, I came across the name Pastor Armstrong. And part of the research that went into this book was none other than the United States and Europe, the United States and British Commonwealth in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. That was part of the research that went into this book about the covenant. And there's a gentleman who I know knows this book. Did you ever get it and read it? Well, I'm sorry. You've got something to look forward to when you do get around to it. Verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. What's the wall? I think that there is evidence to determine that this wall may very well be the Atlantic Ocean. And that may be one of the highest walls in the world right there. And what a miracle it was that the branches and the seed of Joseph, of Ephraim and Manasseh, were able to pass over that wall. The archers have sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him. And boy, didn't it happen to the early settlers. And in the years before a nation, before we broke loose from Britain, before the Revolutionary War, the archers certainly did shoot like crazy. But his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. When I look and I see how many miracles were required for the establishment of this country, and a great many of them on a par with the miracles that God performed to preserve and to sustain our ancient forefathers Israel, and in the wilderness, and in the wars that Israel had to fight in order to achieve that promised land over there. I don't know why we haven't been taught and told about so many of those miracles that occurred that allowed this country to be founded. But they are absolutely stunning. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Well, I think that may very well be a reference back to the stone that was Jacob's pillar stone that has been under the throne on which every king and queen of Britain have been crowned. My dad took me over there to see that. Well, that wasn't the only reason I went over there. That probably wasn't the reason at all, but he took me to Westminster Abbey when I was 14 years old, and I saw that throne, and I saw that stone, and it is still recognized and preserved, and it is one of our connections all the way back to the gentlemen, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, on whose name was founded Israel. Even by the God of thy father who shall help thee, and by the Almighty who shall bless thee with the blessings of heaven above, the blessings of the deep. We're getting some of the blessings of heaven above today. In all my travels as I came down into land in Springfield yesterday evening, that's the darkest shade of green I've seen since I left Texas. Even darker yet. And the blessings of the deep that lieth under. What do you suppose the blessings of the deep that lieth under might be? You don't suppose it's oil. You don't suppose it's coal and oil. You don't suppose it's the source of energy that built this nation, do you? Because certainly none of us would have had the lives we've lived, nor would anybody else in the rest of the world, had we not found out about oil and how to get it and how to employ it and how to use it. You know, I don't know if I ought to, you know, I'll be jumping way out of sequence, but I'm sure I probably already have. We live in a time when our blessings are regarded by our leaders as something horrible and something we should feel guilty about and something we really ought to turn our backs on just as soon as possible. We really need to get away from that nasty, rotten oil. But you know, I had something come to me. Now, Dr. Ricks will be hearing it for the third time, but the rest of you hadn't been following me around near that much. So I'm going to propose this to you today. They tell us that oil is the result of dinosaurs that were buried in, you know, in the floods and in the cataclysms that struck Earth before man got here. So if oil is the result of a bunch of buried dinosaurs and plant life and all kind of things that got buried a long time ago, and it's fermented and through the processes of degradation and so forth over all these aeons, now it's liquid oil, and it is what it is. And if that is what it is, how is that not biofuel? Only a few of you got it, but anyway, maybe the rest of you just didn't think it was worth hearing, but that makes perfect sense to me. How is oil not biofuel? But I'm not sure that oil is the result of rotting dinosaurs, and neither are they. I have seen that even some of the CEOs of the oil companies have proposed that it very well may be that oil is being produced on a constant and continuing basis from somewhere, you know, down there where it gets real hot, and who knows what goes on. And I don't know if it was just buried dinosaurs, how we didn't run out a long time ago. But they just keep finding more and more and more. And it turns out we've got more oil than we know what to do with if we began to actually produce it. But, you know, most of it's off limits. I know they say, well, we're producing more oil now than they did 10 years ago or whatever. Well, that's because they've gone to private lands and actually ended up finding more than what they knew were the reserves under government lands. But I have a feeling that oil isn't what Jimmy Carter decided it was. And I don't know if he was the first one to decide, but it was somewhere in the 70s we found out that oil was a non-renewable resource and we were going to use it all up and then there wouldn't be any more. And they're still playing that game, but I don't think that's true. It looks like there's probably enough oil for at least the next couple of hundred years if they keep going what they know is available already. But anyway, back to the blessings of the deep that lieth under, the blessings of the breasts and of the womb. And we have had a very fruitful country with a very healthy population. And, you know, when you look at what the expected lifespan used to be, and then you look at the age that we're living to be now, and our grandmothers and our moms and dads, a lot of people are living well beyond, you know, two and three times the life expectancy of only a couple of hundred years ago. 26, the blessings of thy father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors under the utmost bounds of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him that was separate from his brethren. Well, I think that it's a pretty accurate proposal that Ephraim and Manasseh, and certainly we here in the United States, are separate from our brethren. And boy, are we ever. We're separate by the Atlantic Ocean, and that's quite a separation. And that's one of the great reasons, I believe, that God planted the descendants of the birthright, of Joseph's birthright, that he planted us here, where our forefathers fought for, first of all, liberty, and where God planted prosperity for us to produce and to work for and to enjoy, and protection of the two mightiest bodies of water on earth. And here we sit. Unbelievable. And I suspect no accident. Well, we've come to a time in our history and in world history where I think you could safely say that the jig is up. We're seeing the forces of evil take hold around the world, and I hate to say it and I hate to see it, but in our country too, in a way that threaten to revoke those covenant blessings, just as Israel sinned in such a grievous way that they revoked the covenant God made with them. You know, some of the Puritans and some of the early settlers proposed that their people at that time, obviously nobody's perfect and none of them were. None of our forefathers or our founders or any of the men in the Bible, save one, was ever perfect. But they proposed that in order to survive, that they seek out and identify those sins for which God punishes those sins which are not minor, but just fly right in the face of everything that is good, and abandon them, to separate those sins far from our people, and to never return to them, to put those completely out of bounds, and certainly never to embrace them, never to nationally legislate sin as a factor in who we are. I can't believe that we're seeing that done. I mean, we've seen it done now for some time. Actually, if you want to go back to the time of Roe versus Wade, and what a blight that has been. I'm glad that the sin of slavery was recognized early on, and it took another man who was very, very much dedicated to God and a praying man, and a man who was led by God, to lead us through really payment for that sin. That sin was paid for in blood, and lots of it. And yet we came out the other side. And I know we've continued to pay for it in various ways. But that was a sin that threatened to destroy the covenant blessings made by the men who came before them. Thank goodness for Abraham Lincoln. Thank goodness there was a man that could lead our country out of that sin and get through to it, through the other side. Yeah. I just said you can see the forces of evil in my notes gaining the upper hand now, and you can literally feel our blessings, our liberty, our prosperity, and our safety slipping away. Do I need to count the ways? 46 million people need food stamps? Are there that many people that are starving? You know, I've been in some pretty crowded spots the other day, you know, in the Atlanta airport. It's just nonstop, just masses of people coming and going in all directions. I didn't see anybody. It looked like they were going the least bit hungry. To the contrary. I know what's happening to our liberties. Oh, my goodness. Well, I better not get on a rant about the TSA, or I'll get way off track. But if that's not an absolute violation of our constitutional scripture, unbelievable. And when you look at who those people are, that really irritates me even more. And to know that while you're in that little area, you are completely under their total control, and there is nothing anybody can say or do about it. I didn't tell this anywhere else I've been, but I read this just a couple of days before I left. That I don't remember which airports, but in several disparate airports, you know, you go through all the degradation of them separating, you know, you from your papers, and you put your wallet over here, and then you go that way in some cases, as I did in Houston. It made me pretty uncomfortable because they sent me about 25 to 30 yards away from my wallet and my identification and everything I have that, you know, are my papers that the Constitution says I'm intended to be secure in my person and my papers. Well, you're not secure in either one of those when you get to the airport anymore. Because they took my papers over there and they took me over here. And I went through and got naked scanned by, well, I don't even want to talk about it. I really don't. But in these last few days or weeks or whatever at the TSA, I don't know why they're doing this, and I can't imagine what the explanation might be. But at some random point in time, one of the officers at the TSA will go, "Freeze!" And they expect everybody literally to freeze. In place. Don't take one more step. Don't move your head. Don't turn around. Don't do anything. You better freeze. And then they start barking at people if they don't understand that they're supposed to freeze in place. And apparently it's not only that the people that are in the security zone, this is even people if they just happen to be in earshot of a TSA agent when he decides to shout freeze, even though they're come from somewhere else and they're just walking through the terminal and they already cleared security, they're supposed to freeze too. It's not very surprising when I've seen who works at the TSA that there have been 400 of them fired in the last year for stealing from passengers. 400 of them. And those people, I think a lot of them aren't fit to work at McDonald's. I mean, no offense to the people that work at McDonald's, but I think, you know, they're certainly more polite and probably of better breeding. It seems that as long as our nation has had some semblance of reverence, of respect for God's immutable laws, of thanksgiving to our Father in heaven, He has preserved us, He has prospered us, He has used us and our great nation to fulfill His promise that we would be a blessing to all the world, even to the blighted, forsaken regions of the world. He's kept our promise. He's kept His promises of the birthright to us. Now our most of our people don't even have any clue about that. They don't know the first thing about it. But now it appears our nation may have irrevocably broken our end of the covenant that was made by our founders and by our forefathers. And this isn't just rhetoric. They did. They made a covenant. They promised to obey God. They promised to keep His laws. They promised to govern in a land that would enforce His laws. Because they knew that if they did, that God would keep His promise. That He would keep His promises of liberty. Something most of the world knows almost nothing about. His promises of prosperity. And His promises of protection. I think we probably, in our lifetimes, we sleep better than anybody on earth. Because we don't have to worry that a Jeep full of, animalistic heathens are going to pull up at all hanging out of a Jeep with a bunch of AKs and attack our home in the middle of the night, do we? We have safety. And I don't know if we appreciate it the way we should. But it means everything. And you think, what it would be like to live like they live in the Middle East when that Jeep might show up in the middle of the night. It just might. Or any other hour of the day. But we have enjoyed all those blessings that God gave to us. And we have been a blessing to all the rest of the world. Can you imagine, had we not gone over there in World War II, when Hitler took over pretty much all the landmass of Europe and was about to take Britain too. And it was a very near thing, and without our help it would happen. It would have happened. Can you imagine the lives that they would have lived in Europe for the last 50 or 60 years if we hadn't done that? If this covenant hadn't been established in the first place, if we hadn't had the blessings and the strength to be able to go over there and liberate our brothers and cousins? Can you imagine what kind of lives they'd have lived for the last 60 years under the barbaric captivity of that demonic Nazism? Unbelievable. I hope they're thankful. We should be thankful. We should be thankful that we were able to do that for them. And some of them helped us in getting established too. I mean, obviously the French had a part in it at various times. Fought against us, and then they fought with us. But we have until now preserved our blood bond with Judah. The United States has had a part in the establishment of the nation they call Israel. I wish they had named it Judah. There'd be a lot less confusion in the world. And maybe among our people too, if they'd have named that little nation over there Judah. And I wish they'd have named us the United States of Israel, but anyway, Amerigo Vespucci, you know, he was led of God too. Absolutely. God had His hand on Christopher Columbus. And it was a near thing that he discovered, you know, the Indies. And he thought he had discovered something attached to the eastern continents. He thought he was over in the Far East somewhere. He went all the way back to Spain still thinking that he had discovered a new part of the Far East. It took Amerigo Vespucci to come find the mainland of America and to let them in Europe know that they'd found the new world. And it became the promised land. And this is where the birthright of Jacob has been fulfilled. And I don't know why our people don't know that, and I don't know why it hasn't been emphasized even in the church as much as it has. Now we live in a time when things are changing, and changing rapidly in ways that we can hardly imagine. Since Israel's inception in 1948, the United States has been Israel's greatest protector, greatest supplier, greatest benefactor. We know that there's blood between the United States and the nation of Israel over there. Or at least we've known up until now. It seems now our leaders want to make better buddies with the heathen than they want to do with the remnant of God's people in Israel. And like I said, it gets confusing. I just want to say Judah, really. I really do. And that we have helped them survive against those heathen nations. And I'll tell you, I mean, the battles go on. I mean, the wars threaten that are all through the Old Testament are still over there threatening to break out again right now. I apologize that I don't know the full extent of what's going on between Turkey and Syria right now. I just haven't had a chance to read up on it to know. And I guess that it's kind of a situation in flux. That Turkey may be about to go to war with Syria, and Syria is allied with Iran. Boy, it's hard to know who to root for in some of these wars, isn't it? It's like, you don't suppose they... Well, no, surely not. But it's hard to root for Syria, knowing that they're buddies with Ahmadinejad. But how many times are we going to see everything in history and in prophecy come a complete full circle? As I was doing some of my study and trying to prepare for the feast, well, actually, I think I even put some of this in an update. But, you know, I go back long enough, and most of you in this room, some of you don't, to remember the time when Iran was the United States' second greatest ally in the Middle East. I bet you kids don't even know that. I mean, I talked to a kid, he was a 20-something kid, in the airport yesterday, and he's going, "What? Iran was an ally of the United States?" I'm going, look it up. Look it up. And I think that was part of that blessing that God laid upon us, that even we have been able to work with some of the leaders in some of the heathen nations. But you know, that same idiocy that inflicted our national leadership in 1979 has taken hold again. In 1979, the United States pulled the plug on the Shah of Iran. We cut off financial aid. We cut off military aid. Jimmy Carter, bless his little peanut-picking heart, stood up and tried to tell us in a speech that they've been playing again lately on television. You can look this up. He stood up and he said that people who believed there were such a thing as good guys and bad guys lived in a fantasy world. He said that Islam was a religion of peace. Well, George W. said that too, but, you know. And he said the Ayatollah Khomeini was a great man. Well, the Ayatollah was in exile in France. He was preaching sermons on cassette tape. Death to America. Death to Israel. Behead the infidels. All this radical nonsense. And he was sending cassette tapes to Iran, and they were being filtered through around the country and through the population. When Jimmy Carter pulled the plug on the Shah had to get on his airplane and run for his life. I don't know if that's what caused the cancer that took him down within a couple of months or weeks or whatever it was. No time at all, the man was dead. I didn't realize until recently that the Shah of Iran and Anwar Sadat, the man who made peace with Israel, man who my father spent 6 or 7 hours interviewing in front of video cameras. I hope to be able to see all of that again someday. I don't know if that had anything to do with Anwar Sadat determining that he would get on an airplane and fly to Tel Aviv and go to Jerusalem and speak before the Knesset. Unbelievable time in our history, in Israel's history, in the history of the world. that Egypt, in this time, in the middle of that Muslim world, would make peace with Israel. I didn't realize until recently that the Shah of Iran and Anwar Sadat were friends, personal friends, called each other brothers, and apparently visited together on occasion. Well, you talk about coming full circle. Jimmy Carter pulled the plug on the Shah in 79, and they raged into the streets. They took over our embassy. They took our American representatives hostage. Talk about history repeating. Now the plug got pulled on Mubarak, Sadat's successor, the man who kept the peace treaty, who thankfully policed the Suez Canal all these years. Now our guy pulls the plug on Mubarak. And he telegraphed the fall of Mubarak at that speech he gave in Cairo. I'm not talking politics here, so if some of you are Democrats, you know, give me a break. No offense. Regardless of what you are, you know, nothing I'm going to say here is going to make a dime's worth of difference in any kind of political context, and that is certainly not my purpose, and I try to stay pretty far from it. Sometimes it's made almost unavoidable because our history and God's plan are inextricably interwoven, and our leaders sometimes can't help stepping on our toes with whatever their philosophies may be. And if we're going to look through a glass clearly, then we're going to see that some of what we need to know overlaps. But when we saw our head of state go to Cairo and give that speech, it's kind of interesting to listen to that speech because he telegraphed the fall of Mubarak. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood was an outlawed organization in Egypt, and yet he insisted that their prime representatives occupy the two front rows. Those guys weren't even allowed to go out in society and identify themselves as Muslim Brotherhood. They weren't allowed to hold meetings. They weren't allowed because they were viewed as political dissidents. They were viewed as treacherous and traitorous, and they weren't allowed to practice their philosophy or their organization. Their organization was outlawed under Sadat and under Mubarak. Sadat obviously gave his life very shortly after he made peace with Israel. They gunned him down. And Mubarak was there. Mubarak was sitting nearby, and he survived it. If not for that, you know, if Egypt had fallen to the radicals back at that time, we wouldn't have had these last 35 years we've enjoyed. But now it's all come unglued. And when I talk about full circle, not only have we seen what's going on in Iran, death to America, death to Israel, they hate our guts. They want to build a nuclear weapon that can blow Israel. I don't think they want to blow Jerusalem up. I think they would love to put Tel Aviv under a mushroom cloud. I think they'd love to kill the lion's share of Israeli population. And now, under this Muslim Brotherhood, you know, they lulled us asleep. They lied to us is what they did. Imagine that. They told us, you don't have to worry about the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power in Egypt. They won't even run a candidate. You remember that? You remember them telling us that? They did. They said, oh, don't worry. You know, this Arab Spring, this is a beautiful thing. This is going to be democracy. This is going to be, you know, a wonderful thing out from under the dictatorship and so forth. Well, now they got a radical. They got a prime representative of the Muslim Brotherhood. And you talk about full circle where Sadat and the Shah were personal friends. Now, this Mohammed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood and little Ahmadinejad are personal buddies. Morsi actually went down there to Iran and appeared at a convention of what they call the non-aligned nations. And I think this is probably going to be the King of the South or the Kingdom of the South, as it can also be rendered. And they got support even from some of the people, you know, some of the nations to the south of us, like Venezuela and Hugo Chavez. He was over there. Oh, yeah, he's one of them. But isn't that interesting? The Shah and Sadat were buddies in alliance with the United States and at peace with Israel. And now Ahmadinejad and his Ayatollah and Morsi of Egypt are buddies But they're not friends of the United States. Well, they may be friends of somebody, but they're not friends of ours. And they hate Israel's guts. And that Suez Canal, that is a huge deal. That is one of the gates that Ephraim controlled for ever so long. And thankfully, it's been under in the hands of a friend until a matter of months ago. But you know what now is going on? The Muslim Brotherhood is allowing Iranian warships out of the Persian Gulf through the Suez Canal into the Mediterranean Sea. That's a huge deal. That is an enormous deal. I mean, they've got missiles that can reach up there from Iran, but to have warships offshore Israel from Iran? And you've heard Iran's boast. You know, you have to take some of them with a grain of salt because they talk through their hat quite a lot. And they're saying that they want to put warships off the Atlantic coast. That coast I woke up on day before yesterday. Well, they got a clear route to do that now if they want to, don't they? They don't have to go all the way around the Horn of Africa. They can just come through the Mediterranean, through the Straits, and if God lets them cross the Atlantic, I guess we'll wait and see. You know, if we ever do get an EMP attack, I was saying up there yesterday, you know, you see it's Amish country. And there's a lot of horses and buggies. There are draft horses out, you know, grazing in the fields. And I mean, cornfields that just go on. They've had a terrible drought, so they didn't do all that well this year. But I said, you know what? If we ever get an EMP attack in this place, the Amish are going to be the only people where life goes on as normal. Because they don't have TV, they don't have radio, they don't have automobiles, they don't have electric lights, they don't have... And we may be learning to live like the Amish, assuming we survive. I don't know what's coming. I don't want to get too far, too crazy or too far out there. So I've been through all this and all that. Yeah. Ever since we have pulled the plug on our allies, and I just find it absolutely unbelievable that the leader of our great nation gives Israel, the tiny nation of Israel, and its fine leader, and I believe that Benjamin Netanyahu is a man of great stature. He's a serious man. You don't see him jiving around up and down stairs and up and down stages and throwing his voice around like some kind of rap artist. Benjamin Netanyahu is a serious guy, and I'm pretty sure he talks to God a lot. And here we're in a place where our president won't even spend the time face-to-face with Benjamin Netanyahu when Israel is under threat of extermination. It's not somewhere off in the years in the future or something that might happen, or it's something that could happen any minute. They have got thousands and thousands of missiles that can reach Tel Aviv in Iran. And I don't know what the match or what the spark might be that might set that conflagration off, but it wouldn't take much. Because those people are just seething with hatred. And if anything, they're calling for it all across the Middle East, all throughout the world, known as the that worships, you know, this God that is the, they call it the religion of peace. We've seen the religion of peace breaking out, hadn't we, on full display all across the north of Africa, all across the Middle East, clear down into Malaysia. Oh, that's just a few radicals. We don't have to worry too much about them. That doesn't look like just a few to me. Does that look like a few to you? That looks like all 1.5 billion of them. Because nobody's stopping them, are they? Nobody kept them from trashing our embassies. Nobody kept them from dragging our ambassador through the streets. And we don't even want to know, and I can't even say what eyewitness accounts claimed they did to that man in the streets of Benghazi. I know why they live like they do. I know why they haven't had blessings over there. I know why they live in dirt, in scorpions and cockroaches, in filth. Sharia law, that's why. A false god, that's why. And yet we've got our leaders telling us we have to respect their false god. We have to pay respect to their false prophet. You know, it doesn't bode well for Israel. It doesn't bode well for the people that God is leading, and obviously God wouldn't be leading any people who show respect for this false religion. I know evil when I see it. You know evil when you see it. I dare say the vast majority of people in the United States know evil when they see it. But we're still being infiltrated, and we're being infiltrated on every level. And it threatens to break that covenant. It threatens to break that covenant that George Washington made. You know, I read that passage, I get so scrambled. What is the matter with me? I should have done this at the time. But George Washington, in his inauguration, and this is absolutely documented, the first president of the United States, so he is the one that began, George Washington is. He is the one that began the tradition of one hand on the Bible and the other hand as in solemn oath or promise. And he wasn't just making his promise to the people, he was making his promise to God. And his hand was not just laid on a Bible, it was laid on an open Bible. And that open Bible was open to Genesis 49 and verses 22 through what I read. And that's where his hand was. He claimed God's promise for this country. I don't think we see a man anywhere on the horizon. I hope we do. I don't know for sure. I mean, it's hard to know everyone's heart. But certainly in recent history, we have not seen anybody of that stature. The closest thing we might have seen, sorry Democrats, was Ronald Reagan. But I believe that was a man who walked and talked with God. And I know that George Washington was a man who walked and talked with God. After his death, and even while he was alive, he was eulogized as having been a leader that was a type and on a par and of a stature comparable to Moses, who led Israel through the Red Sea and through the wilderness and to the Promised Land. The more I read, the more I see how many miracles that were performed, not according to George Washington's will. A lot of the times he thought he was being thwarted. He found out that his life was being saved and that his army had been saved. He thought that the weather prevented him from destroying the British, and found out that the storm that just blew them nearly out of their socks kept them from making an attack that would have been absolutely suicidal on Boston. He found that out afterward. He thought that it had been a real bad omen and a real bad sign that they had been thwarted. Turns out, God saved them against their own good judgment. And it happened time and time again. I have looked for this passage. I tell you, I have got a respect for George Washington now that I wish I'd known of. I mean, I wish I'd had it all my life, and I intend to pass it along, and I intend for my son to learn of it much earlier than did I. I don't know why these stories are not at the absolute core of our children's education, as I said, and could be entertainment too. But there's a passage in that book that I mentioned to you, and it happened long before George Washington became president of the United States. It happened before the Revolutionary War, and it happened in Virginia at a time after the French and Indian War. And there was a ceremony being held, of a peace ceremony of some sort. And there were a lot of assembled Virginians. George Washington was there, seated. And Indian, I wish I could remember his name, Matt somebody, wasn't just an Indian chief. He was a chief of many tribes throughout the northeast coast up there. And during the French and Indian War, which against the British, and when George Washington was fighting on behalf of the Continental Army, they knew that George Washington was a general. And he was targeted. And this Indian chief stood up before this assembled congregation of people, and he told them, he said, "When we went to battle with you," he said, "I targeted you, and I called in my best braves to target you because we knew you were the leader of those men, and we knew we needed to take you out if we were to succeed." And he said, "I'm the best shot you ever saw. I can take out a leaping squirrel out of the tallest tree from a distance of hundreds of yards." maybe not hundreds of yards. It was muskets after all. I don't know how far. But anyway, he said he could take a squirrel from the leaping from the top of the tallest tree. And he brought in his braves who were the best marksmen. And this Indian chief, I wish I'd have brought the book up here. I could read it exactly. His words were recorded. He said, "We shot off your hat. We killed your horse. We've perforated your clothing." But he said, "We couldn't lay a scratch on you." And he told George Washington and himself, and he told that assemblage of Virginians, he said, "Surely the hand of God is on this man." He didn't say the hand of God. He said the hand of the Great Spirit. He said, "Surely the hand of the Great Spirit is upon this man." And George Washington said, "You know, I'm pretty sure the Great Spirit's had something to do with you too." It was just such a beautiful thing. I can't read that book in the airport because I'm telling you, it is absolutely an emotional experience. But God has been on the hands of our leaders. He has protected us and He has sustained us. I think we're reaching a point where He just might not anymore. When they legislate abortion as part of our national character, where they're making us all pay for it through some kind of health care nonsense, that's all federal government now. All the doctors pretty soon are going to be federal agents like the TSA. I don't know. When they legislate gay everything, when the president comes out and says he's evolved to the point now that he supports gay marriage, I'm pretty sure he didn't have to evolve all that much. When we find out that the Navy runs on biofuel at 5 times the cost of the blessings of the deep, we find out that chaplains are performing gay ceremonies, and I'm pretty sure I read that it even one took place on a base in Missouri where it's not recognized and it's not lawful. But it is on a military base, apparently. Is that right, Wes? Yeah, he's nodding. He's a military man. He's not still in, but he's still attached some way or another. And they allow the sailors to choose their bunk mates. Do you think God is going to see their mission through? Do you think He's going to protect them? Do you think that they're going to succeed with God's blessing and His help and His hand of protection that has been there, and I dare say throughout World War II, certainly, God intervened on numerous occasions, as He has down throughout our history. Now, we're at a point where not only may the blessings be pulled away and revoked, we're in danger of punishment in this country unless we turn this thing around. I don't know if it's too late for our country. I hope not. But what I see illustrated in our history, not only in the history of Israel, but in the history of Britain and in the history of the United States of America, is that when we make covenant with God to be His people, to observe His laws, to confess our sins to Him, and to walk with Him daily, that He keeps His promises. He has kept His promises in a way that I've seen here in my travels in the last few days. It is just a mind-boggling thing. It is just a mind-boggling thing to see all of this arable soil and how it is all carved into the fruited plain. And I'll tell you, it is just unbelievable when you see it. And you see it from that height. It's just incredible what He has given us here. But we also know that when we break our promises to God, He still keeps His promises. And that's when they turn against us. So I think we're at a point, it's got to start somewhere. And I have a feeling that Washington, D.C. isn't going to be the place that it starts this time. I want it to start with us, ladies and gentlemen. Because we're going to need His help in what we see coming. We need to reestablish our personal covenant with God, not only to accept the blood and the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for our ultimate spiritual salvation, but for our families, for our kids, for the blessings that we still have and we still enjoy now, I propose that we all take God up on His covenant offer, on His promises. Because I think we're going to want liberty, prosperity, and safety. And those are the three tenets. Those are the three main points of God's promise and His blessings upon us. I think we're going to need that. We're going to need the comfort of it. And I have a feeling we're going to have reason to go to our knees a lot in the days and weeks and months. And I don't know if there are years ahead or not. I don't know how many more of these Feasts of Tabernacles we'll be able to come and observe and enjoy. But this is certainly, you know, there aren't very many people doing what we're doing today around the world. Very precious relative few. But we are here to help hold up our end of the bargain. And I hope we'll continue to do it when we leave the room, as we go about our lives, because we are going to need the hand of protection that God gave to our founding fathers and to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're going to need that hand upon us as we go through the times ahead. And we all want to be here. We all want to be a part. When Jesus Christ returns to this earth, as He will, to smite the nations, to rule the world with a rod of iron, we want to be in that kingdom. And we, you know, it's hard to imagine sometimes how it could be much better than what I saw in Indiana or some of the beauty you have here, or even what I see in East Texas. I just think, you know, this feels almost like a kingdom. It is just so plentiful and so beautiful and so wonderful. I hope that we continue to appreciate it, and I hope that we continue to observe it. And for me, looking forward to that kingdom and knowing where we've been in the wilderness and knowing the wilderness that is out there in the world is really what this Feast of Tabernacles is all about for me, and I hope for you. It's been wonderful being here with you. I get to be here for a little while this afternoon, and I hope you all have a great rest of your feast. I'm off to the West Coast. God bless all of you. Thanks for being so nice.